All right, last week of the semester. It's been a long haul. We're entering, though, a week of pretty interesting material. Democracy from below. Now, in a way, that's a kind of strange title, because democracy should inherently be governance from below. That's its whole point. It's rule of the people. But as we've seen in practice, even though we continue to have what could be called formally democratic institutions, the actual exercise of power isn't really all that democratic. It's not really the people governing. And thus, the expression democracy from below could also be thought of as the ideal or the aspiration to democratize democracy itself. The way to think about this problem is as follows. There's really two kinds of ways that the ideal of democracy gets translated into actual institutions. The more familiar is what we call representative democracy. Representative democracy is a form of democratic rule in which the people rule only to the extent that they get to select the people who actually make decisions. That's familiar. That's elections. Elections are a way of choosing the people who will actually exercise power. Now, that's a genuine democratic principle, mind you. I'm not saying that's phony. No, that's a good, practical way of organizing the idea that it's the people who ultimately are in power because they get to decide who makes the decisions. And if they don't like the decisions, the principle is you can change the people who do so. The premise, of course, is that the design of the way in which elections take place allow for a relatively untroubled translation of the interests and preferences of the people who are doing the voting into the actual decisions that get made via the intermediary of the representative. And as we've seen, there's all sorts of ways in which that smooth translation gets disrupted. So there's a second ideal of democracy, which is sometimes called direct democracy. And here the idea is that the heart of democracy is the active participation of ordinary citizens in shaping and making public decisions. Active participation of ordinary people. And since you're all adults, it would be active participation of people just like you, who would actually be involved, not merely in every once in a while going to the polls to choose representatives, but actually engaged in the process of making public decisions that matter, exercising the power of the state through direct participation. Well, most people's reactions to the idea of direct democracy is it sounds good, it would be nice, but it just isn't practical. It's just not possible. Yeah, maybe in the 19th century or before, in small New England towns, you could have the New England town meeting where all the citizens assembled, or as many as wanted to, and they voted on the budget and decided on whatever new ordinances were needed in the form of a village assembly. But that's in a very simple environment. You can't possibly have direct democracy in a complicated world such as we have today. But what I'd like to explore in this lecture are a variety of ways in which the idea of direct democracy can, in fact, be brought to bear on public decision making in the world as it is, not in some romantic image of a small town. And that indeed there are plenty of ways in which direct involvement, active participation of citizens already are in place, and additional ways that we could imagine. Some of these are quite familiar. Here's a list of pretty familiar ways in which ordinary citizens are actually involved in exercising power, not just choosing delegates. Juries, that's the simplest case, what is a jury? A jury is empowering a panel of 12 people, that's the typical jury, to make a decision about the use of state power through the courts. That's direct democracy. We discussed in an earlier lecture the issue of initiatives and referenda. That these are laws, actual laws, that are just simply voted on by citizens. The closest thing we have to initiative and referenda in Wisconsin are local bond issues. Those of you who have voted in local elections will know that sometimes on the ballot there'll be a bond issue to build a new high school. In the last election, there were many school bond issues asking the citizens to increase the taxes on themselves in order to do things like build a new high school or remodel an old high school or fix the roof, because the ordinary city budget didn't have enough resources to do that. A bond issue is a loan. It's asking the city to take a loan from banks or from other sources of financing to cover the costs of some big infrastructure project. And in the last election, actually, quite a few bond issues passed in Wisconsin, a surprising number. It's been tough going for bond issues by local governments in recent decades because of the general aversion to paying taxes. This sort of anti-tax ideology has percolated all the way down to an anti-tax ideology around building schools. But that seemed to have been relaxed a bit in the last election, and quite a few bond issues passed. Well, that's direct democracy. You see, that's one person, one vote, deciding on raising taxes, because basically a bond issue requires that you pay more taxes to cover the bond issue. A public hearings, another familiar example. Sometimes these are rituals. You know, you'll have a city council that'll be discussing some controversial city ordinance, and 100 people will show up to say their piece, and the city council will just ignore what's said. It'll be all for show. Window dressing is the expression that's used to describe things like public hearings that really don't matter. But actually, in most cases, I think public hearings have at least a marginal effect and sometimes a big effect. They're a way for politicians to see what's on the mind of citizens. And if they have a feeling that what they're hearing are authentic voices of citizens who are really concerned about something, at least in some settings, people listen. Politicians may actually feel it's their responsibility to listen, not just to speak. And they will respond. And decisions in city councils get changed by virtue of public hearings. That's another way that ordinary, everyday citizens can get involved in actually influencing the way power is exercised. Public issue campaigns. These are special focused campaigns around some issue. Ordinary people get involved in public issue campaigns, sometimes for progressive causes, sometimes for conservative ones. New England town meetings, I've already mentioned, they still exist. I have some friends who teach at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst, Western Massachusetts. They live in a small town nearby, not in Amherst itself, in some small town. Perhaps it's a village. I don't know what the boundary size is between a village and a town in Massachusetts. And they say every year they meet and they discuss things like, should we have an additional, hire additional person in the fire station? And should we, is it time to get new fire trucks? And will we raise the taxes or not to do so? All the issues that come to bear on a local community get decided by a show of hands in the General Assembly of the town for certain issues. And finally, a really familiar form of popular involvement, of ordinary people getting involved in politics, are social protests. And I'd like to do, as a little interlude, a revisit of the Wisconsin protests of 2011. Since I have a lot of photos here, let's dim the lights. Let's see, is that going to be too dim? Is that too dim? Well, what do you say?
Let's see what this looks like.
Intermediary.
Let's try that.
2011. Well, you can come down. I'm going to show you a bunch of video clips in the course of this lecture. This will be a tour of interesting, innovative things that are happening. But I will begin with the Wisconsin protests. So I've briefly told you the story of the protests. You just need to man the lights. When I show videos, I'll make it even darker so that you'll be able to see them better. The story is, I think, familiar. I briefly did it. In February of 2011, a bill was introduced by the Walker administration, which came to be Act 10, which was a bill to abolish public sector unions. It was called a budget repair bill. It was introduced under the pretense that we were in a budget crisis, and we had to cut wages and benefits to public sector workers, which means especially teachers. That's the largest category of public sector workers. Cut wages and benefits of public sector workers. But the actual details of the bill were not really about the budget crisis. The actual details of the bill were to make it impossible for unions to function by eliminating their capacity to bargain over anything but wage increases up to the rate of inflation, which essentially means you have no capacity to bargain. You can't bargain to improve the conditions of your members. And as I said, you had to have a vote to recertify every single year in which you needed a majority of the eligible people to vote for the union, not just the majority of the people who actually voted. A very tough demand requirement in order to win a certification election. You also couldn't automatically deduct dues. You had to get people to write you checks. There was no check-off. A check-off is when you have your paycheck and various pieces of your pay get allocated to different purposes, like withholding taxes, for example. It used to be that if you were a union member, your dues would be automatically deducted from your pay and go into the union. Now you had to directly allocate that money yourself each month. This was a bill to destroy unions. It triggered the largest protests in Wisconsin history by a significant margin, really huge protests. At the peak, there were over 200,000 people protesting at the state capitol. And there were protests throughout the state in smaller towns, all over the state, including in parts of the state which are not particularly Democratic. The protests were not just by Democrats and liberals. There was a very widespread protest. The heart of the protest was a physical occupation of the state capitol building for 17 days, in which this occupation happened kind of by accident. The story is really interesting. There was hearings being held in the assembly over this bill. And until the hearings were concluded, the bill couldn't be introduced on the floor of the assembly for a vote. So people started testifying. And it occurred to some of the people who were involved in the protests that if they could keep people testifying, maybe they could do it indefinitely, just have thousands of people testify over weeks and weeks. Maybe they would just delay the bill enough that a sufficient number of politicians would decide, no, this isn't worth it. Let's modify the bill. So the tactic was to keep the hearings going. Interesting idea as a way of having a protest. Just have the public hearings keep going on. So the Teaching Assistants Association, which is a union, which at the time the co-presidents were from the sociology department. So sociology was at the heart of this drama. Teaching assistants unions sent out email blasts and social media to get people to testify. And that then activated even more energy inside the Capitol building. Well, here are pictures. These are photos that I took from time to time during the protest. This is what it looked like inside of the Capitol building. Day after day, big rallies, lots of students from UW, especially from the School of Education, lots of young future teachers were protesting the destruction of the teachers' unions. This is a picture, not one that I didn't take, from some website showing the size of the crowds on some of the bigger demonstrations. And now just scenes from inside the building. Kill the Bill was the slogan that was used. I love Wisconsin unions. Wisconsin forward, not backward. I think many of you will know that the slogan of the state motto is forward, progressive idea. Wisconsin forward, not backward. I went to Iraq and came home to Egypt. This was a veteran from the Iraq War. Egypt refers to the Arab Spring. This was occurring at the same time that mass protests in Cairo against the military dictatorship in Egypt were taking place. Democracy is two wolves and a sheep voting on what to have for lunch. Liberty is a well-armed sheep contesting the vote. Apparently Benjamin Franklin said that. Five states in the U.S. specifically prohibit collective bargaining for teachers, which is in effect what the bill did here. Their rankings in combined ACT, SAT scores are as follows: 44th, 47th, 48th, 49th, and 50th. Wisconsin is currently tied for second. This is a response to the general view that teachers' unions harm education. All the evidence indicates that where you have strong teachers' unions, you have more commitment to teaching. Teachers feel they have a longer time horizon, more security. They're protected against arbitrary actions by school boards and principals. And therefore, overall, it generates a better environment for learning in schools, not a worse one. One of the really interesting things that happened during the protests was that a pizza place close to the Capitol, Ian's Pizza. Early on in the protests, they brought all their leftover pizzas to the people who were sleeping over in the Capitol building. This got on national news, and suddenly Ian started getting credit card orders from all over the world to provide free pizzas for the people inside the building. So there were all these pizza boxes that were stacking up because the pizzas were being delivered to the protesters. And so people started using the pizza boxes as posters. This is at a sign out in front of Ian's that indicated a running list of where they were getting orders for pizzas. It's really hard to, you know, it's 7 years, 6 years later. In the moment of this thing, it was just an extraordinary feeling. Wisconsin was at the center of global discussions about democracy, workers' rights, public protest. It was in the newspapers all over the world. Subsequently, when I was giving some lectures in Taiwan, I mentioned this when I did my little slideshow of my growing up so you could see that I didn't bite. I showed, I think one of the pictures was of me doing a little seminar discussion inside the parliament building in Taiwan, in the capital, with students who were occupying their national parliament. And they had been inspired by the Wisconsin protests. They all knew about the occupation of the state capitol building here. And that was one of the reasons why they thought this would be a good way of putting pressure on their government as well, in what was called the Sunflower Movement, because the sunflower, for accidental reasons, became the symbol of their democracy protests. Wisconsin protests in 2011 become inspiration for Taiwan. I mean, it's not that the Sunflower Movement as such was inspired by what we did, but that idea, the repertoire of action, what can we do? The idea let's break into the state the National Capitol building. In their case, they actually occupied the chambers of the parliament. They were in the main assembly chamber, not just in the rotunda like we were. But this idea that what undergraduates were doing here, lots of undergraduates were camping out in the Capitol building, would be seen and listened to by their equivalents halfway around the world, and a couple of years later, be part of the general consciousness of what you do when you're protesting. I thought was just an extraordinary moment to me. I was practically in tears when I was meeting with these students and recounting the Wisconsin experience and hearing from them of their experiences. Well, I'll run through these pretty quickly. This is a statue of Fighting Bob La Follette, a great hero of early 20th century Wisconsin, one of the leaders of the Progressive Party, the Progressive Movement in Wisconsin, who was behind the idea of the what's called the Wisconsin idea, that the university, the boundaries of the university are the borders of the state, and our purposes are to serve the public good. And what would Bob do was a kind of gesture towards that Wisconsin tradition. People camping out. This is the teaching assistant situation room, where they were given a particular space by one of the assembly persons in which they could set up a media center and an information center and be involved in coordinating various things connected to the protests. Testify was the word. I hadn't testified initially, and one of my graduate students saw me in the hallways. I was, you know, taking in the scene. I went every day. I deeply regret that I decided not to sleep over. I just was just for the. I would have just liked to have, in retrospect, have done it. I just felt too creaky, and the idea of sleeping on a marble floor just seemed like a big hurdle. But I should have done it. I should have slept over with the crowd. At any rate, I was buttonholed, and I was told, come on, you've got to testify. So I went to the room where you testify and got my name on the list. There were 200 people ahead of me at that point. So I was told to come back in 3 hours. When you testify, you've got, I think, 3 minutes to say your piece. So I came back at the appointed time, and then I was ushered into the assembly hearing room along with the other, I think it was 25 people at a time. So I was able to sit there and listen to all these testimonies before I gave my testimony. The testimony in the hearings are just why you object to this bill or support it. I mean, the hearings could be for either side. For me, it was quite an extraordinary moment. I had not done such a thing. It's not that I had decided not to ever testify at a public hearing. I believe in public hearings. I just hadn't done it. It just wasn't something that was part of my own menu of things I do to express my political will. But I was doing it there, and I got to listen to 24 other citizens of Wisconsin telling their stories about why this bill was harmful. Some of them were telling personal stories about why, how they had been helped deeply by their teachers in high school or in elementary school, reflecting. Some of them were, one was a mother who had a child who was autistic and needed the extra resources that came from Badger Care, and another part of Act 10 was to dramatically cut back on the state support for what's called Badger Care, which is the medical Medicaid for the poor in Wisconsin. So there were other issues besides just unions. And there were union members who were not necessarily directly affected by this bill, because some of them were private sector workers. This was just a public sector bill. But who spoke as to why they felt unions were important. And then it was my turn, and I gave some very academic-y argument about the importance of unions for democracy. You know, more or less the themes that we talked about, and about why military dictatorships abolished unions so quickly, and why it was important in a democracy in which we have very few restrictions on how money can play a role in democracy, that we need to have as much as possible easy ways for ordinary citizens to be involved in associations, of which unions were crucial, and so on. I gave my rap on unions and democracy. For me, in that hearing, in that room, it was really the first time that it just struck me, you know, and that people have these moments where it's just, you have an experience of a direct character that just makes you feel differently about something. It made me really feel different about Wisconsin. I mean, I've lived here since 1976. I didn't grow up here, but I've lived here more than half of my life now. But, you know, I really never exactly would have said I was a, quote, citizen of Wisconsin. I mean, that I lived here. It was my base of operations, right? I mean, I love teaching at the University of Wisconsin. I've got lots of friends. I enjoy the amenities of Madison. But I kind of more thought of myself as, if I wanted to use some extravagant expression, a kind of cosmopolitan citizen of the world. This was my base of operation. And then I would fly off to Taiwan to give a lecture, or next week I'm going to London and then Germany and Sweden to give lectures. So, invited lectures by universities and research institutes. So I gallivant around the world and I see that as my stage in a kind of pretentious and probably overblown way. But I never, and I thought I lived in Wisconsin. This was my home and it always felt good to come back. But I never really thought of myself as a citizen of Wisconsin. And there in that hearing room, I really had that feeling. These were people like me, even though they were very different. We shared a common fate in the state of Wisconsin, and it mattered. It's really quite wonderful for me. It reflects something that's very fundamental about the idea of democracy, is that actual participating in the stuff of democracy is what makes you feel part of democracy. You know, makes you feel that this is important. It's the act of participation and engagement with other people that makes you feel, yes, we're all basically in this together. It's not an abstract idea, it's a real idea of the interpersonal interactions. And the testifying at that hearing, I never anticipated it would matter. I mean, I knew it was worth doing, but I didn't think it would have an impact on me. I wasn't doing it in order have a kind of an epiphany about my own place in this community, but that is actually the way it played itself out. They set up a child care center so families could come and leave their kids in a nice protected corridor. One of the rallies afterwards, the assembly members who were opposing the bill all wore these orange shirts, t-shirts. This became a very famous picture. It was about 20 degrees outside when this character was walking around in this outfit. Some of these signs became iconic, and you know, I think Now You've Pissed Off Grandma went around the world. There was a fantastic tractorcade of farmers. Farmers are normally not thought of big supporters of unions or of sort of liberal causes in general, but there was this large tractorcade of farmers from southern Wisconsin that came to the Capitol building towards the end of the protests and had this parade around the square in their tractors. I thought Ballerinas for Fairness, a little girl was carrying the sign. I thought that was about as sweet as you get. It's a little poignant. Jesus was a carpenter, Pontius Pilate was a governor. The walker referred to the demonstrators as union thugs. So of course that again became a, you know, a moniker that people adopted. Okay, now whoops. Let me just show you a brief video. This is a collection of video clips. I think I've got the video system mastered here. So let's see if we, so I thought, huh? Let's see. Number one, I think, turns them all off.
Thank you.
Whoops. So much for my belief that I had gotten this all. No. It just went to the next video on that. Okay. There's going to be more. There's going to be a bunch of nice little videos. All right. Well, that was the Wisconsin protests of 2011. Much more to say about it. But the big question is this: can arenas of direct participatory democracy be meaningfully expanded in a complex society. Protests are good and an essential part of a democracy, but protests inherently act as pressures on a democratic process rather than the core of the democratic exercise of power. Protests are not an arena within which thoughtful discussions of the nuances of alternative policies, alternative bills, can be worked out. The protest may help set the stage for the kind of deliberation and discussion needed for democratic rule, but protests can't be at the heart of it. They have to be articulated to some structures. Question then is, can we enhance direct participatory democracy in a meaningful way? Can this become a more institutionalized part of democratic life? Well, I think this is possible, and what we'll do now is explore a number of ways in which this is happening. In my own research on this problem, I refer to the kind of participatory democracy that we need to foster, or I would like to see fostered. I refer to it as empowered participatory governance. It's participatory, but it's participatory not just in the sense of symbolic expression, but participatory with real power attached to it, so that the citizens involved in the participation can be directly involved in making the relevant policy decisions. And we'll explore a range of contexts in which this is happening. The first is what could be called empowered neighborhood associations. Now, many cities, maybe most cities, I'm not sure, but probably most cities, have organizations that are referred to as neighborhood associations. I live in the area of Vilas Park, near where the zoo is, and there is a Vilas Park Neighborhood Association. And it organizes things like a 4th of July picnic and provides a venue where people can raise concerns about various projects that are occurring in the city. So when Edgewood College, which is nearby, was planning some major change in the way their sports grounds were organized, which would affect the parking and the traffic in the area, and there was going to be public hearings, well, the neighborhood association got involved. That's a typical thing that neighborhood associations do. What's very rare is for neighborhood associations to actually have power. That is, where they can actually decide on various policies that directly affect their neighborhoods. They're not really typically like a sub-unit of government that has its own capacity to do things. Well, there's a very special case in a region of Boston. Anybody here from Boston? Boston area? So Dudley Street is a corner of Boston in the area that's called Roxbury, a very poor part of the city. But a poor part of the city that's close to the center of the city in ways that actually makes it potentially quite valuable real estate. But it's very poor and has been for a very long time. Dudley Street is one particular corner of the Roxbury area. And here's the bare bones of what happened. In the early 1980s, this was a really devastated part of the city. There were vacant lots that were used as dumping grounds for trash. People would come and just dump their used appliances in these areas. It was used as a public disposal place. And private trash collecting companies sometimes would just dump their stuff in these vacant lots rather than take it to the landfill because it was more convenient. There were also lots of abandoned houses, and then fires were set in those abandoned houses for insurance purposes. Lots of insurance fraud by landlords whose properties had deteriorated, and it was more advantageous for them to burn them down mysteriously and collect the insurance than it was to rehabilitate them. It was a really devastated neighborhood. Well, a group of do-gooder type, liberal do-gooders from Cambridge, Massachusetts, from Harvard area, decided that they could help this poor, blighted community, and they got a big grant from some foundation, a few million dollars, And they had all these plans about what they could do to make life better for the people who lived there. So they organized a meeting in the Dudley Street area to tell them what they were going to do. And the neighbors, the people in the neighborhood, were outraged that these white, liberal, smart, educated people were coming to their neighborhood, even though they had a lot of resources, and telling them what they needed. And they were booed and shouted down and basically chased out of the neighborhood. Well, usually that would be the end of the story. You know, if something like this happened, the liberal do-gooders would retreat and lick their wounds and think of something else to do with the resources they had. But in this particular case, one of the people involved said, we screwed up. This was not an appropriate way for us to relate to this community. It was disrespectful. And he went back and spoke, I think, initially to some pastors in the area and had a second meeting in which they said, look, we completely screwed up. It was utterly inappropriate. Just treat us as a resource that you can use. We have expertise in various things. We're here to help, but you tell us what to do. The residents were pretty skeptical, understandably. But there was enough of them that decided, okay, let's see what happens. So they formed the Dudley Street Neighborhood Association, or Neighborhood Initiative, to decide what strategies would be good. And then they called on the expertise of these people, which included lawyers and engineers, city planners, architects. And they had this idea, what if we could get what's called the power of eminent domain? So the power of eminent domain is a power that cities have to seize property, to pay for it at whatever the market rate is for that property, but to seize it for some public purpose. It's commonly done, for example, when there's a highway being built, and the highway has to go somewhere, and the properties that are in the way get condemned, that's the expression, through the right of eminent domain for public purposes. The owners get compensated at supposedly fair market price, and then the city owns the property to use for its purposes. So the Dudley Street people said, look, we've got all this abandoned property. Why can't this just be seized as abandoned property for public purposes, and then we in the Dudley Street neighborhood will decide what to do with it? So the strategy was to use eminent domain to turn all of these vacant lots into what's called land trusts. A land trust is a way of having property rights in land that is not private. It's owned by some community under conditions of a trust. So there's technical stuff, it doesn't matter. It just means that the land is available for the purposes of the community and is not subject to a market exchange, taking land out of the market for a public purpose. It's different from ownership by a city, because it's not up to the city council or the governor or the mayor what to do with it. It's a land trust held by the neighborhood association in trust. The problem was that they didn't have power of eminent domain. Neighborhood associations don't have that power. Cities do. Then a very peculiar set of political circumstances occurred. There was a very bitter, racially charged mayor's election, and the white mayor who won decided he needed to somehow or other appease the black community that felt very wounded because a very prominent and respected black candidate had lost this election, but in a fairly bitter way. And for whatever the political power brokering reasons were, the city government decided to give the Dudley Street Neighborhood Association the power of eminent domain so they could decide which pieces of land to seize and what to do with it. That was the key thing that made this an empowered neighborhood association, not just a neighborhood association who could make recommendations to the city. Once they had that power, then they could set up their own planning machinery. Then they could tap into this expertise from the people from Cambridge to figure out how to design low-cost housing on land trusts that would be made available to people in the neighborhood, how they could turn some of these lots into community gardens. And here is a short video. About this experience.
I think in many ways people would have done anything with that scene home, not as commodity, but as something that should be part of human rights.
Going once, going twice, say goodbye to your house. But the foreclosure rate skyrocketed as the real estate market continues to crumble.
The story has been with us for some time. In Massachusetts alone, over 12,000 properties are in foreclosure. But in the Dudley Street Neighborhood Land Trust, where homes are owned by low-income residents, not one is in foreclosure due to the credit crisis. Why not? 25 years ago, hundreds of homes in the Dudley Street neighborhood were being torched for profit by absentee landlords. The 1,300 lots left behind became a dumping ground for Boston's trash. Then the community organized. They created the Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative. They challenged City Hall and came up with a new solution, a land trust to build new homes that would be permanently affordable for low-income residents.
They were talking about home as a place that they wanted to be to find shelter, to find a good neighborhood, to find people who want to share the same values with them, that they can interact in ways that are healthy.
My name is John Barrows. I've been a resident all my life for 17 years. I hope to represent the age bracket which is seriously lacking here, and I'd like to see some things change and more youth participation from kids from my age. Thank you.
Mr. Justin, when I was younger at the organization, I really thought of organizing as a profession. You know, I was a resident, and it was just my neighborhood, and it was about improving my neighborhood and believing in the value of improving your neighborhood, being involved. And until one day it clicked, and then some 9 years later, I'm sitting here.
I'm 14 years old. I have devoted half of my life to youth.
The youth basically muscled themselves into the room and said, we're a part of this conversation too. And now you have the youth that grew up in the organization out running.
More than 500 vacant lots on the land trust have been transformed into homes, gardens, parks, schools, even a town common. More than 200 homes have been built on the land trust and are already occupied. The last 18 in the original community plan are ready to be sold.
This is a great opportunity for you as new neighbors and also for us as a community.
A recent DS&I lottery offered them to pre-qualified buyers.
Geneva, Miami, Dorchester.
Boston resident, 25% minority, 10% women. Okay. So make sure that you're talking the talk. You got to walk the walk, understand?
The community also needs to develop young leaders and continue organizing its young residents.
Yes, and I have a real challenge to try to organize outreach to involve and engage all of the youth in the community. Continue to train, continue to understand, see, feel, experience, and grow in yes, and I.
One of the biggest challenges to the community is the current economic and housing crisis. Many see the Dudley Land Trust as a possible solution to the growing number of home foreclosures in the neighborhood.
So not all the homes in the neighborhood are on the land trust. So although we can protect the homes around the neighborhood from foreclosure, we actually have a really high rate of foreclosure in Roxbury and Dorchester in general. So we haven't been immune to that as a neighborhood. In fact, we're very worried about the types of issues that cannot have abandoned foreclosed homes in our neighborhood. And there's a real threat that the foreclosure crisis can take us back a few decades in terms of potential drug homes, in terms of some prostitution, some places for, in case of foreign gangs, high out. So we want to acquire some of the homes that they have been foreclosed on to rehab, resell them.
The credit markets have to open up in order for us to continue to move forward the dream of having more homeowners in affordable housing.
How does a community like Dudley keep looking forward and protect what has fought long and hard to win? Facing neighborhood foreclosures on the one hand and the hopes of the next generation on the other, the Dudley community and DS&I stand between opportunity and vulnerability. How does a community gain the ground it needs to sustain hope and pass on a legacy of community vision, struggle, and change?
Thank you.
So the point of that story is, on the one hand, inspirational, of course. It's just inspiring to see a community be able to transform itself in the way that this Dudley Street area did. But here's really the issue. They were able to do it because they were empowered. They had the actual capacity to solve problems. And that requires, on the one hand, a legal form. The city gave them eminent domain. It also requires resources. They had to be able to have a way of purchasing through eminent domain and turning into a land trust, the land. And then they could control the character of the development to put permanent, low-cost, but decent housing on it and to sustain that over time. That does require resources. They received most of their resources through foundation grants of various sorts. That is not from government, but from private foundations that were interested in treating Dudley Street as a kind of experiment. Well, imagine if this experiment were scaled up, and in which the funding to make it possible for neighborhoods in poor parts of cities to turn vacant lots into trusts to purchase foreclosed houses and rehabilitate them, again, under land trusts. Imagine if the funding for this came from taxes as part of the general view that, yes, having this kind of neighborhood is a public good. It's not just good for the residents, it's good for the city, it's good for everybody if the poorer parts of communities can live like that rather than live in devastated, disorganized settings. Part of what deepening democracy would mean then is both empowering neighborhood associations to engage in this kind of creative planning and managing their affairs, but also providing the public resources to make this dynamic and creative, to make it possible for them to turn the dreams and plans into practice. Well, that's One example, empowered neighborhood associations. Here's another example. It's called participatory budgeting. Participatory budgeting is an idea that began in Brazil, in the city of Porto Alegre. I talked about it on the weekend, but not, yeah. I was just at a weekend retreat with graduate students, and we talked about participatory budgeting. Having talked about it recently, I thought, have I already said this in this class? No, I haven't talked about it here. It's a very interesting idea. The basic idea is take part of the city budget. In Porto Alegre, it was a substantial part. In other places, it's a small part. And let's just have the citizens decide how to use it by meeting in public meetings to form committees to propose projects for different uses of the city, this pot of money, and then have citizens vote on it. Well, this started in Brazil, and recently it's spread to the United States to a number of cities. The most, I think, dynamic example of participatory budgeting is now occurring in New York City. The basic context is that the city council members in New York City each have a discretionary budget that they can use for the sorts of purposes that constituents in their districts want, such as filling potholes. That's the classic thing. You're a city council person, you've got a $2 million discretionary budget, somebody calls you up and says, there's a terrible pothole in front of my house, and rather than wait for the normal city maintenance to take care of it, you can use your discretionary budget to fill the pothole. So it's on the one hand serving the needs of your constituents, it's also obviously a way of politicians to be popular with their constituents, to solve problems of various sorts. A number of city council members in New York decided that they would let the citizens of the residents of their districts tell them what to use the money for through a participatory budget. And this has now spread to, I believe, 25 or so districts in New York. And here is, do we have time? We have 5 minutes. How long is the, let's see how long this video is. This video is 4 minutes. I think we can do this and then we'll continue this.
Register us in kids called Real Power or Real Money to make decisions that affect their lives. It's a democratic process in which ordinary people members directly decide as members of our public
voters. This is different because you're actually voting for the money that's going to be spent instead of allowing them to decide where to spend money.
Who knows better about their community?
Not be afraid of the big words, participatory budgeting. It sounds boring, but it's the opposite of that.
Sound is boring. First, people brainstorm ideas. They come together in meetings and assemblies and start to think of what kinds of projects they'd like to see in their neighborhoods.
Yes, it's big. We have $1 billion that we can use so we can fund parks, health issues, streets.
Volunteers work with experts to turn people's initial ideas into full project proposals.
We started with maybe about 40 projects, and so we had a series of budget delegate meetings, and we narrowed down the list into about 4 or 5 projects.
We met with the Parks Department and we talked about what we wanted to see change in some of the parks and how we were going to work with them.
What are the real needs of the community? Do you want to have a certain amount of money? What is it that you can do that's going to benefit as many people as possible?
I'm dreaming of new benches, wider benches, seniors have no way to go.
Displays and bus shelters throughout the district, and it will tell people when the next bus is due to arrive.
We're asking for a projector, library, and laptops.
State-of-the-art fitness center.
To put solar panels on a firehouse.
And the volunteer shares on projects. The community deserves to vote.
So when validating
that me as a representative and government should respond and should listen to that whole people. Anybody can go through this process, immigrants, whether you're documented or not, the people that normally don't make the call.
Most people, they don't know this, you know, the logical thing. Some of them are really surprised. It really does begin. They have a voice.
Projects with the most votes get funded. The Red Hook Library Community Art. The projects can be implemented for the next few years. And the following year, the process starts again. People brainstorm new ideas, turn them into new projects, vote on them, and fund more improvements for their community. TV becomes part of the budget process. It becomes a new way of working.
I think this is like the greatest wave of democracy coming into the United States. We're starting with virtual labor in Brazil in 1989.
From there, it spread all over Latin America to over 1,500 cities around the world. In Toronto, public housing tenants have decided to spend millions of dollars on improvements to their buildings. City council members in Chicago, New York, and other cities have engaged thousands of residents in allocating discretionary funds. Entire cities are launching TV, such as in Vallejo, California, for funds from a sales tax. And Boston for youth funds. Even schools and universities have used PD.
This was a great opportunity for you to be a part of government and better the city you live in. Like, who wouldn't want to take advantage of that?
We're creating a more educated platform of voters overall. So I think this can only be good for the big project of democracy.
So, I'll tell you a little bit more about participatory budgeting in the next lecture, and I'll see you on Thursday.